The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Our topic today is the transition of Presbyterianism from the old world to the new. Very important, but in many ways a very difficult matter to discuss. Charles Hodge, in his Constitutional History of the Presbyterian Church in the United States of America, admitted that, and I quote, "the early history of the Presbyterian Church in the United States is involved in great obscurity." End of quotation. Great obscurity, that's not an auspicious way in which to begin discussing our topic. But let's continue with the Hodge quotation for just a moment, because I think this helps us as well. Hodge says this, "the early history of the Presbyterian Church is involved in great obscurity. The reason for this fact is obvious. Presbyterians did not at first emigrate in large bodies or occupy by themselves extensive districts of country. In New England, the early settlers were Congregationalists. Their history of that portion of our country is in great measure the history of that denomination. The same remark to a certain extent is applicable to the Dutch in New York, the Quakers in Pennsylvania, the Catholics in Maryland. The case was very different with regard to the Presbyterians. They came, as a general rule, as individuals or in small companies and settled in the midst of people of other denominations. It was, therefore, in most instances, only gradually that they became as sufficiently numerous in any one place to form congregations or to associate in a presbyterial capacity." So that gives us some understanding of why this topic is not going to be an easy one to deal with. In light of our difficulty, we might well ask another question. Who was the first American Presbyterian? Well, answering this question could help us to understand some elements in the transition of the Presbyterian Church from the old world to the new. But before we could even identify who qualifies for the title of first American Presbyterian, we need to take one step further back and seek a general definition of Presbyterianism which would fit the realities of the church in the 17th century. On the strictly theological side, we could say that Presbyterianism was Calvinistic in doctrine. The Westminster Confession of Faith defined thoroughly the Presbyterian church's theological perspective in the 17th century. But of course, the theological thrust of the Westminster Confession was basically shared by numerous other groups as well. And therefore, it does not help us simply to say that Presbyterians were Calvinists. So were many others. Therefore, the focus of our attention, again, the point in this is to try to identify the earliest American Presbyterians. The focus of our attention in that effort must move, I think, from theology to ecclesiology. And here the distinctions among various early settlers in America become clearer. The most important distinction to be drawn among the early settlers is that between Congregational Calvinists and Presbyterian Calvinists. Leonard Trinterud, in his extremely important work, The Forming of an American Tradition, A Reexamination of Colonial Presbyterianism, Trinterud summarizes the traditional historical understanding of the difference between Congregational Calvinists and Presbyterian Calvinists. This is what Trinterud says. "The issues upon which Puritanism in England had finally divided into Congregationalists and Presbyterians grew out of two seemingly irreconcilable concepts of the church. To those of the Congregationalist persuasion, the Church of Christ on earth existed only in its individual congregations. The Church Universal was but the totality of these congregations. To the Presbyterian wing of Puritanism, the Church Universal transcended all its local manifestations, being an entity greater even than the sum of its parts. It was the one body of Christ. From these two starting points, each group went on to differ with the other on a number of crucial issues. End of quotation from Trinterrude. Trinterrude goes on then to trace the various implications of these differing concepts of the church, the local versus the universal. Among the most important of the implications were, in Trinterrude's mind, an understanding of church membership, an understanding of the nature of ordination, an understanding of the office of ministry. Behind all of these specific differences lay contrary concepts of the extent of the church. At least that's what Trinterrude, in keeping with traditional historiography, has argued. But I'm not quite so sure of the ease of those distinctions. Remember, we're still trying to identify the first American Presbyterian or Presbyterians. And in order to answer that concern, that question, I think we need to reconsider carefully the degree to which the distinction outlined by Trinterrude was actually maintained in early mid-17th century New England. If, for example, if it can be demonstrated that the religious establishment of Massachusetts Bay, which most scholars, including Trinterrude, would identify as Congregationalist, if it can be demonstrated that the Massachusetts Bay religious establishment actually operated on the basis of a more or less regional church concept, then the question of transition from old world to new will take on greater clarity. So what we need to do is to focus on whether the ecclesiological distinction is going to be the one that helps us most in identifying early American Presbyterians. Let's go back to Charles Hodge, because he has some further light on this subject. Hodge reminds us that Presbyterianism, separatism, and what he calls the middle way of non-separating congregationalism all originated in dissatisfaction with the extent of the Reformation under the auspices of the Church of England. The original break with Rome occurred for other than doctrinal reasons, and the subsequent history of the Anglican Church, and I realize that that's an anachronism, it was the Church of England, not the Anglican Church, but I'll be using that term for brevity's sake. The subsequent history of the Anglican Church was, to say the very least, checkered theologically. For example, the regents of King Edward, the son of Henry VIII, the regents of King Edward, moved the church to a more thoroughly reformed theological position. Mary, Henry's eldest child, his eldest daughter and his eldest child, Mary sought to return the church to the Roman Catholic fold. And Elizabeth, who ruled from 1558 to 1603, had taken a more politically pragmatic attitude toward the church. Those who sought genuine reform had experienced various types of persecution under Elizabeth, and that kind of persecution continued. Indeed, it increased under her successors, James I and Charles I. What's fairly well known about this situation, and we're talking now about the state of the Church of England in the early part of the 17th century. What's fairly well known about this situation is that those who opposed the Church of England establishment had become known as Puritans because they wanted to purify further the Church of England. That's generally well accepted. No reason to quarrel with that understanding. What is perhaps not so well known is the degree to which Presbyterianism dominated the early English Puritan movement. Once again, Hodge describes the situation accurately when he says that, and I quote, "The great majority of Puritans in England were Presbyterian." End of quotation. They were Presbyterians because intrinsic to their ecclesiology was the conviction that the fate of the church in England, rather than the fate of the various individual congregations in England, the fate of the church in England was of paramount importance. This corporate sense continued to dominate Puritan thinking when individual Puritans moved from England to New England. In fact, the only nonconformists who genuinely rejected the entire Presbyterian way of thinking of the church were the separatists, represented best by such individuals as Robert Brown, John Smith, John Robinson. The separatists despaired of achieving adequate purification of the Anglican establishment. They were determined to bring about, in Brown's own words, a quote, "Reformation without tarrying for any." And they were committed to doing so by forming their own separate congregations in which the appropriate purity was much more achievable. This was the first Anglo-American rending of the previously seamless regional church garment. Its impact, I would suggest, has been felt by all Christians, even by those who today regard themselves as Presbyterians. But the Presbyterians, this is my point, now going back to the distinction that was suggested by Trintarud, that the whole thing comes to ecclesiology, and that Hodge seems to substantiate by dividing these groups into Presbyterians, separatists, and non-separating Congregationalists. My point is that the Presbyterians and the non-separating Congregationalists together rejected the separatist way. Both Presbyterians and non-separating Congregationalists believed that the biblical teaching about the church required them to see it as an institution in need of reformation, to be sure, but one church nevertheless. Fascinating story is how the difference between Presbyterian Puritans and non-separating Congregational Puritans began and how that difference developed during the middle part and the latter part of the 17th century in the New World. So what we're focusing on now is the difference between those who are traditionally called Presbyterian Puritans and those who are traditionally called non-separating Puritans. And we're focusing on that to try to determine whether the earliest Puritan establishments in New England can be called Presbyterian. Normally they're not. Normally they're called Congregational. And Hodge and Trintarud both would say that that's appropriate, that they were not, those early New England establishments were not Presbyterian. But let's now return to our subject. Basically the difference between these two latter groups of Puritans, remember who we're talking about. We're talking about non-separating Congregationalist Puritans on the one hand and Presbyterian Puritans on the other. The difference between these two groups of Puritans arose largely out of pragmatic considerations that led the separatists to renounce completely any notion of the church universal. Both Presbyterians and non-separating Congregationalists, both of these groups, recognized that the struggle to reform the Church of England was a difficult one. Ecclesiological differences developed around the question of how difficult the task was perceived to be. Okay? To simplify, I hope not to oversimplify. Those who remained Presbyterian in orientation had more confidence in the possibility of reforming the entire Church of England establishment than did those who became non-separating Congregationalists. Events in Scotland, particularly under John Knox's leadership in 1560 and after, those events encouraged many of the Puritans to believe that the ongoing reformation of the entire national church was possible. The single-minded resistance by Elizabeth and her two successors, James and Charles, their resistance to such thorough reformation convinced others among the Puritans that while purification of the church as a whole in England was the ultimate goal, real progress would only be made as individual parts of that whole, on their own, individually, conformed completely to the Word of God. Those who took this line, the church as a whole ought to be reformed, but it's unlikely that we're going to get there right away. Those who took this line were not fully Presbyterian, but they were not separatist either. Let's try to approach this question another way. Another way to deal with the distinctions among these various groups in Britain in the late 16th and early 17th centuries is to focus on the selection of church officers and the degree to which church and state are coextensive. And I need to remind us again that all of this we're doing to try to understand when and where and how and through whom Presbyterianism came into the New World. Okay, so we're now going to look at the selection of church officers and the degree to which church and state are coextensive. You see, both Presbyterians and non-separating Congregationalists believed that the Anglican way of choosing church officers was unbiblical. Rather than appointing local church officials from the lofty reaches of an ecclesiastical hierarchy, both Puritan groups believed that church leaders were more appropriately chosen by church members. But the Presbyterians among the Puritans were actually closer to the Anglicans than they were to the non-separating Congregationalists in their understanding of the coextensiveness of church and state. Following the model that was being developed in Scotland, Presbyterians identified church and state quite closely. Not, to be sure, in terms of jurisdiction or authority, but in terms of membership. You see, for both Anglicans and Presbyterians, citizenship and church membership were correlative, if not synonymous. Presbyterians determined to achieve what they regarded as necessary reformation by changing the method of choosing clergy and by taking the presbytery out from under the direct control of the political sovereign. That was then the Presbyterian approach. The non-separating Congregationalists, in effect, did not believe, after 30, 40, 50 years of trying, did not believe that the Presbyterian method was going to work. They were convinced that as long as those who elected elders were themselves potentially unreformed, the officers they chose to lead them might very well continue to be unreformed. Therefore, non-separating Congregationalists earned their Puritan appellation by focusing initial attention on the purification of local congregations. Now, in that way, immediately we see some of the similarities between non-separating Congregationalism and pure separatists. But, a very important exception, non-separating Congregationalists did not in any way abandon the goal of reforming the regional church. And since they didn't abandon that goal, it's clear that they didn't abandon their understanding that there was a regional church. And that's where they differed so decisively from the separatists. Non-separating Congregationalists believed there was a regional church and that we must not abandon the goal of reforming that regional church. Therefore, because they focused so much of their attention on the regional church, it's quite proper to regard them as having very significant Presbyterian leanings in their ecclesiology, in the way they understand what the church was. Obviously, the...
Hold 1 5 seconds, and they'll stop these, or they'll be very noisy when they stop while you're talking. We can't pick up now.
Obviously, the process by which non-separating Congregationalism came to focus its purifying attention on local church membership was a very long and complicated one. It's very fascinating. Love to talk with you about that sometime, but today's not the day. What has been suggested is a summary of ecclesiological developments over a half century and across 3,000 miles of salt water. And the details of this shift have been told by many others, most famously by Perry Miller in Orthodoxy in Massachusetts, also by Edmund Morgan in his book Visible Saints, The History of a Puritan Idea. My objective has been much simpler. It's been just to summarize this development for the purposes of comparing Puritan non-separating Congregationalism to Puritan Presbyterianism. And my point has been that there are some very significant similarities between Presbyterianism and non-separating Congregationalism. As a matter of fact, I would argue that the comparison I've just suggested indicates that Presbyterianism in early 17th century Britain was a very different thing from Presbyterianism today. I need to repeat that. Presbyterianism in early 17th century Britain, England and Scotland, was a very different thing from Presbyterianism today. Likewise, non-separating Congregationalism of that same period must not be regarded as identical with Congregationalism in the United States at the present time. Now, these facts have got to be the context for us as we try to talk about the transition of Presbyterianism. Too often when we announce a topic like that, we immediately read our current understanding of Presbyterianism back into the 17th century, and that creates historiographical problems. I would go further. I would go so far as to say that it may well be that 20th century American Presbyterianism has more in common with 17th century non-separating Congregationalism than it does with 17th century Presbyterianism. Did you pick that up? What I'm saying is that Presbyterianism in the United States today looks a lot more like 17th century non-separating Congregationalism than it does like 17th century Presbyterianism. And this is just one of the reasons why identifying the first American Presbyterian gets so inordinately difficult. Well, let's go ahead. We're going to keep on. It's hard, but we're going to keep working on it. As we move into the second quarter of the 17th century, the difference between both earlier and modern Presbyterianism and earlier and modern Congregationalism become even clearer. Let's look, for example, very briefly, at the political nature of the National Covenant, which was signed at Greyfriars Kirk, Greyfriars Church in Edinburgh, in 1638. And then, correlatively, at the affirmation of the Solemn League and Covenant in 1643. Both of them, you see, these are fundamentally Presbyterian affirmations, and both of them reveal a concept of the coextensiveness of church and state that has no place in modern American Presbyterianism. In other words, both of those documents, the National Covenant, the Solemn League and Covenant, seem to assume that church and state are the same in terms of membership. Anybody who's a member of the state is a member of the church. Anybody who's a member of the church is a member of the state. They assume that fact, and that fact is very foreign to modern American Puritanism. I'm sorry, modern American Presbyterianism. Perhaps even more to the point is the degree to which non-separating Congregationalism represented both a corporate sense and a view of church membership with which modern Presbyterians would be both familiar and comfortable. Again, my point, just to reiterate, is that the more closely we study 17th century, mid-17th century non-separating Congregationalism, in terms of its understanding of the corporate sense, the extent of the church, and the view of the church membership, we, I think, would realize that those perspectives are quite close to the theological perspectives of modern American Puritanism, modern American Presbyterianism. A central question, therefore, might well be this. Why did English Puritans of the non-separating Congregationalist variety come to America in such large numbers at the end of the beginning of the second quarter of the 17th century? Okay, I've made the point that there are some remarkable similarities, theological similarities, between mid-17th century English non-separating Congregationalism and modern American Presbyterianism. And this is in the context of our trying to decide when did Presbyterianism come to America and through whom did it come. So now we're going to ask, why did these non-separating Congregationalists come to America in such large numbers beginning in the late 1620s? John Winthrop was a layman, one of my favorites as a matter of fact, and he was an extremely influential leader among the Puritans who migrated from England to Massachusetts Bay. He was a native of East Anglia, within which were located both Cambridge University and the greatest concentration of Puritan sentiment. Winthrop, I think, represents very well the classical, non-separating Congregationalist mindset. Deeply distressed over the failure of the English Church to complete the Reformation, Winthrop felt mandated by Scripture to deal with the results of that failure in corporate terms. Like most other Puritans, he believed that God related not just to individuals, but also to corporate units, of which various individuals were parts. Specifically, Winthrop shared the Puritan understanding of a national covenant. This meant he believed that a nation which lived in disobedience to God could expect to be judged by God. While on business in London, on May 15, 1629, Winthrop wrote the following letter to his wife, and I quote, "My good wife, I praise the Lord for the wished news of thy welfare and of the rest of our company, and for the continuance of ours here. It is a great favor that we may enjoy so much comfort and peace in these so evil and declining times, and when the increasing of our sins gives us so great cause to look for some heavy scourge and judgment to be coming upon us. The Lord hath admonished, threatened, corrected, and astonished us. Yet we grow worse and worse, so as his Spirit will not always strive with us. He must needs give way to his fury at last. He hath smitten all the other churches before our eyes, and hath made them to drink of the bitter cup of tribulation, even unto death. We saw this, and humbled not ourselves to turn from our evil ways, but have provoked him more than all the nations round about us. Therefore, he is turning the cup towards us also, and because we are the last, our portion must be to drink the very dregs which remain. My dear wife, I am verily persuaded God will bring some heavy affliction upon this land, and that speedily. But be of good comfort. The hardest that shall come shall be a means to mortify this body of corruption, which is a thousand times more dangerous to us than any outward tribulation, and to bring us into nearer communion with our Lord Jesus Christ and more assurance of his kingdom. If the Lord seeth it will be good for us, he will provide a shelter and a hiding place for us and ours." Pardon a personal comment here, but wouldn't you like such a man to be the governor of your state as he was for 27 of the first 30 years of the Massachusetts Bay Colony? Well, let's move ahead here. To Winthrop, the individual was primary. It was the individual who exercised faith in Jesus Christ, that was regenerated, and was going to heaven. So the individual was primary, but Winthrop was also very conscious of the degree to which the group was also real before God. And this affected his understanding of the church and the state and led to his decision to travel 3,000 miles to try to set up a holy commonwealth in which both church and state would live in obedience to the Word of God. Paramount among many reasons for the transition by the Puritans from England to New England was this corporate sense. And this notion is in basic agreement with the Presbyterian understanding of the church as a regional corporate body. And it was indeed at the very heart of the Great Migration of the 1620s and 30s. We need to go on to point out, just to remind ourselves, that the group of Puritans which came to Massachusetts Bay was very different in crucial ways from the group which settled at Plymouth, Massachusetts. Plymouth, the site of Plymouth Rock, Thanksgiving, and all that. The Plymouth group, known to later generations as the Pilgrims, the Plymouth group was comprised primarily of separatists. As one reads, for example, William Bradford's journal, History of Plymouth Plantation, and contrasts it with Winthrop's History of New England, one is struck continually with the degree to which the former, that is Bradford's work, the former breathes a spirit of individualism, both in personal and church life, while the latter is much more conscious of corporate realities. Therefore, when we speak of the movement of this Presbyterian-like, that's all I'm saying right now, when we speak of this movement of the Presbyterian-like corporate sense from England to New England, we must be very clear that we're referring not to the settlers at Plymouth, but to the much larger colony established some 10 years later around Boston, Massachusetts. I am arguing that it's this latter group which influenced in a major way the development of American Presbyterianism. But if Winthrop and those who came with him felt that the body of which they were parts in England was increasingly corrupt, and that the sickness of that body threatened their own health, what exactly did they do after arriving in Massachusetts to achieve a healthy body? And I think as we look at what they did, again we see what I would regard as Presbyterian tendencies. In a word, those who arrived in Massachusetts Bay, the Boston area, sought to safeguard membership in both the church and the state in order to protect and provide for biblical holiness in both. The Puritans never confused church and state. Never. To their way of thinking, each had its own distinct function and stood in a corporate relationship, in covenant, they would say, with God. Both church and state were required to be obedient to God's word. And as reflected in Winthrop's letter to his wife, both church and state should expect the favor of God in the physical realm, the material realm. Both church and state should expect the favor of God if they obeyed his word. His judgment, God's judgment, was certain if they disobeyed it. Now again, I have to have a caution here. To be sure, they knew the book of Job was in the Bible, and they knew the relationship between obedience and blessing, disobedience and curses was more complex than that. But they did understand the Bible to teach that there is some link. There is some real, genuine link between obeying God and receiving the blessings of the covenant. The actual structure of church and state in New England in the early 1630s is described in great detail by Edmund Morgan, whose writings are just superb. I highly recommend them. In his volume, The Puritan Dilemma, The Story of John Winthrop, Morgan describes that structure of church and state in early New England. To summarize that structure briefly, the franchise was restricted to male members of Puritan churches. That is, only male members of Puritan churches could vote in political elections. Furthermore, membership in those Puritan churches was limited to those individuals who demonstrated doctrinal orthodoxy, lived sanctified lives, and perhaps most importantly, were able to describe the ways in which they had actually experienced God's grace. Now, several things need to be said about this structure at the very beginning. First of all, only those who could vote could hold political office. The Puritans were hoping thereby to make significant progress toward building a society that genuinely held the glory of God as its first priority. From the beginning, however, ministers were prohibited from holding political office. The official lines between church and state were drawn clearly for all to see. Now think about that. A minister could not be governor, could not be an elected town representative. And Winthrop's journal traces in great detail the relationships between elected political officers and church officers. To be sure, frequent disagreements between these two groups, political officers and church officers, arose, but there was no confusion between them regarding their respective roles, rights, and responsibilities. Second point about this structure, focuses on the question of fairness. Many modern scholars, for good reason, question the restriction of the franchise to church members. Is it fair to say that only church members can vote? They accuse the Puritans of narrow-minded bigotry. In response to such a charge, it must be stated, while not denying the force of the charge, it must be stated that political liberty simply was not a very high priority for the Puritans. The highest priority was the glory of God. Now, here is where the distinction between Massachusetts Bay and Plymouth becomes particularly crucial. Individual liberty was the highest priority in Plymouth. It was not in Massachusetts Bay. Building a holy commonwealth, a society which would bring honor to God, that was the number one priority in Massachusetts Bay. Obviously, as in almost every society since then, we really want both, but at some point priorities are going to clash. In Plymouth, when they clashed, individual liberty won out. In Massachusetts Bay, at least in the 1630s, 40s, and 50s, when the clash occurred, the understanding of God's glory won out. If in Massachusetts Bay, if achieving the glory of God required the sacrifice of other legitimate values, the Puritans were willing to make that sacrifice. Modern America, however, with its near deification of individual liberty, simply cannot understand a mindset which genuinely, revealing some of my biases now, which genuinely sought to worship the Creator rather than the creature. Having said all of this, it's still necessary to recognize and to discuss the degree to which Puritans in Massachusetts Bay were more or less narrow than their counterparts in England, and similar statements could be made about other countries as well. We need to recognize, be upfront about, the fact that the Puritans sought to set up a society based on a rather narrow franchise, a narrow band of people in the community could vote. Okay, we need to recognize that, but we need to go on to say that this was very common in the 17th century world. Interestingly, the difference between England and New England was not the percentage of individuals within the society who could vote. In both societies, it hovered around 15%. The real difference was in the way in which those who could vote were chosen. In New England, as we stated, a fundamentally spiritual criterion was utilized. In England, the criterion was overtly economic. In English society, in the mid-17th century, voters had to possess a 40-shilling freehold, obviously a property-based or an economic franchise. Narrowness, at least if you're interpreted in terms of the percentage of people who can actually vote, narrowness can therefore be no more charged against the New England Puritans than it can be charged against their English counterparts, who were, for the most part at this time, members of the Church of England. Indeed, what was true in England was true in most other European countries of the day. What was distinctive about New England was not in the percentage or the numbers or the narrowness of the band of those who could vote. What was distinctive was the fact that the Puritans felt the most important criterion was spiritual and not economic. Third point, talking now, still talking about this structure that these early Puritans set up in Massachusetts Bay. Third point, this has to do with the specific criterion the Puritans utilized for membership in their churches. In addition to the normal British Puritan and continental criteria, which usually included doctrinal orthodoxy and a moral life, those were the normal church membership criteria. That's what people looked for. If you were an outsider coming into the church, that's what was looked for. In addition to that, the New England Puritans requested applicants for membership in their churches to describe the experience they had had of the grace of God. This criterion has been roundly criticized by many historians, theologians, who've argued that the Puritans thus were guilty of the old Donatist heresy of perfectionism. They wanted only a perfect church. Nothing could be further from the truth. The Puritans asked candidates for membership in their churches for nothing more or less than a credible profession of faith, a request made by most conservative American Presbyterian churches today. This and nothing more than this was sought by the Puritans can be confirmed by even a cursory perusal of the confessions of faith of about 50 people who actually applied for membership in Thomas Shepherd's church in Cambridge, Massachusetts between 1638 and 1645. Narrations of grace were written down by members of the congregation, and they have been recorded and published. And as one reads them, one realizes that not only were the Puritans not Donatists, but in the matter of church membership, they were actually much closer to conservative 20th century American Presbyterians than to other 17th century British and Continental Presbyterians. The Puritans of New England believed in the corporate nature of God's people. They sought, both by their active church membership, by their criteria for church membership, and by the franchise criterion, to do all they could to achieve a holiness in both the political and the ecclesiastical units. In this corporate sense, therefore, the New England Puritans, I would argue, and here we're coming back to one of our main points, in this corporate sense, therefore, the New England Puritans were therefore more Presbyterian than congregational, at least as those two terms are normally understood in the late 20th century. The fact is, as one examines the way in which Massachusetts Bay, both church and state, dealt first with Roger Williams and then with Anne Hutchinson, one is impressed with the Presbyterian character of those dealings. For example, when the church at Salem wished to hire Williams as its teacher, it was strongly counseled not to do so by the other Massachusetts Bay churches. That's the kind of thing that would happen at a presbytery level. The church at Salem declined to follow that counsel, and the general court then entered the picture to enforce the judgment of the other churches. I would say then that the actions of both the court and the churches was so clearly Presbyterian that we have a good explanation of why Roger Williams, subsequent to these actions, charged the churches of Massachusetts with having abandoned the principle of congregational independence. Roger Williams saw it. He saw that what the churches of Massachusetts were doing was Presbyterian, and he accused them of it. And indeed, he renounced them for it. Well, dealings with Ann Hutchinson were no less definitive. One church, the Boston Church, seemed to be moving in the direction of accepting Hutchinsonian antinomianism. And we don't need to worry about all that that was, but it was regarded to be a heresy. And one church, the Boston Church, seemed to be moving toward accepting that heresy. Meetings and councils of the other ministers in Massachusetts Bay were called in to deal adequately with this threat to the doctrinal well-being of the entire corporate community. Because they were convinced of the essential unity of the civil and ecclesiastical bodies, the Puritans could not and did not allow challenges to that unity to go unchecked. Now, it may be that the New England Puritans acted in this manner because, as Cotton Mather remarks, more than 4,000 Presbyterians entered New England prior to 1640. In other words, Cotton Mather, a late 17th century Puritan minister, makes the point that there was a lot of Presbyterian influence in Massachusetts Bay in the 1630s, and that may be why the church as a whole acted like a Presbyterian church. But even more likely is the simple fact that these Puritans, from the very beginning, shared essential theological positions with Presbyterians of that day and of this day. I would argue that their essential theological position made these early Puritans Presbyterian, even if they didn't realize it themselves, even if they didn't use that name to describe themselves. Once again, let's hear Charles Hodge. He's usually got very, very good insights here. This is what Hodge says. The influence of Presbyterian principle in New England is, however, much more satisfactorily proved by the nature of the ecclesiastical systems which were there adopted than by any statements of isolated facts. These systems were evidently the result of compromises between two parties, and they show that the Presbyterian was much stronger than the independent element. The two leading points of difference between Presbyterianism and Congregationalism, particularly as the latter exists at present, relate to the mode of government within the congregation, whether it should be by elders or the brotherhood, and to the authority of synods. As to both these points, the early discipline of the New England churches approached much nearer to Presbyterianism than it does at present. End of quotation from Hodge. Well, if all of this is true, however, why were there so many outspoken statements of opposition to Presbyterianism in New England in the 1630s and 40s? Why specifically did both John Cotton and Thomas Hooker write formal treatises seeking to vindicate the congregational system as over against the Presbyterian? Well, to be sure, it would be inaccurate to suggest that New England Puritans actually were Presbyterians in every way. They did seek to maintain, at least in theory, a degree of congregational independence that moves away from a Presbyterian model. Nevertheless, two facts about the Presbyterianism of these New England churches need to be kept clearly in mind. First of all, as I've tried to indicate earlier, their corporate sense made it impossible for them to see their churches as completely isolated, separated from one another. Each church was a part of the whole, and it was in terms of the whole that each church was expected to act. Therefore, the theoretical independence of the church was largely mitigated by the even greater practical emphasis upon the unity of the body. Secondly, this is most important, and it has to do with what I've said earlier about the different ways of understanding Presbyterianism in the 17th century and the 20th century. The reaction which we frequently see in early New England to Presbyterianism was to the Presbyterianism of that day. As already suggested, Hooker and Cotton and many of the other New England Puritans identified Presbyterianism with the church-state situation which in their opinion had proven inimical to true reformation and biblical holiness. While the church-state model might seem to be successful in Scotland, Scotland was under the political control of England. In New England minds, the Scottish church was incapable of living as fully by the Word of God as New Englanders thought was necessary. Therefore, it was the 17th century version of Presbyterianism that saw church and state as coextensive. It was that version of Presbyterianism that Cotton and Hooker were rejecting. They were not, in my judgment, rejecting Presbyterianism as we understand it in the late 20th century in America. To gain a better understanding of that 17th century version of Presbyterianism, at least as understood by New England, it's necessary only to read chapter 23 of the original version of the Westminster Confession of Faith. Section 3 of that original chapter reads as follows. The civil magistrate may not assume to himself the administration of the word and sacraments or the power of the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Yet he hath authority, and it is his duty to take order that unity and peace be preserved in the church, that the truth of God be kept pure and entire, that all blasphemies and heresies be suppressed, all corruptions and abuses in worship and discipline prevented or reformed, and all the ordinances of God duly settled, administered, and observed. For the better effecting thereof, he hath power to call synods, to be present at them, and to provide that whatsoever is transacted in them be according to the mind of God. End of quotation from the original Westminster Confession of Faith. New Englanders feared this kind of arrangement and rejected such Presbyterianism. However, when the Puritans of Massachusetts Bay came to adopt their own doctrinal statement, the Cambridge Platform of 1648, they not only adopted without change all the doctrinal sections of the Westminster Confession of Faith, but they also created what has been astutely called, and I quote, a congregationalized Presbyterianism or a Presbyterianized congregationalism. As a result of this doctrinal stand, New England was criticized both by British independents for exercising too tight control over individual churches and by Scottish Presbyterians for allowing too much diversity among the churches. In fact, however, the New England Congregationalism of the Cambridge Platform has remarkable similarities to American Presbyterianism as we know it at the end of the 20th century and as it is represented in the form of the Westminster Confession that is used by modern American Presbyterian churches. One of the most fascinating discussions of the Puritan attempt to maintain theological unity within the churches and of the degree to which this represented a form of Presbyterianism is Philip Gura's, that's G-U-R-A, Philip Gura's book, A Glimpse of Zion's Glory, Puritan Radicalism in New England, 1620 to 1660. And one of the most illuminating aspects of Gura's discussion is his consideration of the Woburn Memorial of 1663. In that protest, that's what the Woburn Memorial was, in that protest, 10 individuals petitioned the General Court objecting to a recent order of the church in which it was stated that, quote, no person in this jurisdiction shall undertake any constant course of public preaching without the approbation of the elders of four of the next churches or of the county court. End of quotation. Now that quotation is from the Woburn Memorial of 1663. In their memorial, these petitioners, quote, arraigned the Massachusetts General Court for encouraging both Presbyterianism and Erastianism, end of quote. What do you suppose the court did with the petition? Well, of course, the petition was dismissed by the court. But I think the very fact of its existence seems to verify from yet another source that it really was a form of Presbyterianism that existed in early New England Puritanism. So in the 1640s, 1650s, New England was increasingly Presbyterian, I would argue, in orientation. These were crucial years because it was precisely at the same time that New England Puritans began moving south into Long Island and New Jersey. Leonard Trinterud, whose book I've mentioned several times, is just one of the historians who has documented this particular migration. He describes, for example, the movement of Francis Doty, an English Puritan of decidedly Presbyterian views, from Taunton, Massachusetts, to Mespet on Long Island in 1642. Charles Hodge, Lefferts Letcher, William McKinney also chronicle these early years of Presbyterian settlement in the Middle Colonies. The point is that the earliest settlement in this country, which could clearly be regarded as Presbyterian, was begun by New Englanders drifting down into the Middle Colonies and bringing with them the theological perspectives and ecclesiastical models of early Massachusetts Bay. This was a very critical aspect of the overall transition of Presbyterianism to the New World. Okay, so we're now looking at the decades 1640s, 1650s, 1660s. And what I've been arguing is that New England Puritanism out of Massachusetts Bay had some very decidedly Presbyterian ingredients, and that one crucial part of the transition of Presbyterianism from the old to the new worlds came as New England Puritans migrated south from New England into New York, particularly Long Island, into New Jersey, and into Pennsylvania. This movement was beginning as early as 1642, and it picked up momentum in the next several decades. At the same time, and here's where most of the attention is usually focused when the discussion is of the creation of an American Presbyterian church. At the same time, much larger numbers of Scottish Presbyterians were moving directly from their homeland to the four northernmost provinces of Ireland, the area that we now know as Ulster. The history of the Presbyterian Church in Ulster is a fascinating story in itself, but we're not going to be able to discuss that here. I would recommend the book Wayland Dunaway, The Scotch-Irish of Colonial Pennsylvania, published by University of North Carolina Press in 1944. The point is that these Scottish Presbyterians, moving from Scotland to the four northernmost provinces of Ireland, brought with them a very rigorous doctrinal form of Presbyterianism. And their new circumstances there in Ireland caused them to clarify their doctrinal precision even more fully. It was, after all, basic biblical doctrine that separated these Presbyterians from their Roman Catholic counterparts in the southern provinces of Ireland, and from the Anglicans, from whom they received such persecution in the middle decades of the 17th century. And we must remember, as Trinterud again points out, quote, the Presbyterians of Scottish origin who came to America during the colonial period were mostly from Northern Ireland. Few came direct from Scotland. Scotch-Irish Presbyterianism, while transplanted originally from Scotland, had been modified in many ways by its experiences of poverty and persecution in Ireland. During the 1640s and 50s, slow migration of these Scotch-Irish to the middle colonies of the New World was taking place. By the middle 1680s, there were enough Scotch-Irish Presbyterians in the middle colonies to warrant an appeal for pastors from Northern Ireland. The respondent to this appeal, which formally had gone out from Colonel William Stevens in Maryland, was Francis McCamee, often called the father of American Presbyterianism, and often also called Francis McKimmy. But I'm going to call him McCamee here. No sooner had McCamee arrived in Maryland in response to this summons than he began church planting work, not only in Maryland, but also along the coasts of Virginia and the Carolinas and down into Barbados. McCamee seems to have been the catalyst, drawing together many of the incipient strands of Presbyterianism in the Middle Colonies. The Presbyterianism that gathered around him was thus a combination of these two distinct strains, the New England Puritan strain and the Scots-Irish strain. And these two strains coming together would form a unique new form of Presbyterianism. While McAmee preached and planted churches through the Middle Colonies, events were transpiring in New England, which would move some aspects of Congregationalism there even more in a Presbyterian direction. For example, October 23, 1684, it's the date that I often like to say on which Puritanism in the New World ended. A dramatic statement, but it gets people talking and thinking. October 23, 1684, the Massachusetts Bay Puritans were notified that the King of England had annulled their charter. The crisis had been brewing for many years, but the event nonetheless was traumatic. It was traumatic because loss of the charter meant the loss of the Puritans' ability to structure their society, church and state, as they saw fit. Concomitantly, it meant a dramatic challenge to the corporate ideal of a holy commonwealth, because without the ability to restrict the franchise to church members, the Puritans now, at least in their estimate, had lost the essential means of bringing the church and state in obedience to God. And without such political means at their disposal, the Puritans, who were disinclined to abandon their corporate sense, recognized very quickly that a formal Presbyterian arrangement of the church was their last best option. Consequently, Increase Mather. The Mather family was certainly the most important single family in the first 100 years of the Massachusetts church. Very controversial, but between the three, Richard, Increase, and Cotton, you have the leadership of the early New England church. Increase Mather, the middle of the three, was in London in 1691 seeking to negotiate the return of some kind of charter to New England. And he joined with other ministers in sponsoring a document entitled the Heads of Agreement. This plan was essentially a union of Presbyterian and Congregationalist ministers, which was designed to make it possible to retain some degree of spiritual hegemony in New England in both the church and the state. Increasing secularism, centered particularly at Harvard, made it impossible for Mather to sell his plan at Massachusetts. He was opposed by a wide variety of churchmen, and the Heads of Agreement consequently came to naught in his home state. The concern that had been inaugurated by the loss of the charter and exacerbated by the developments at Harvard had more specific results in Connecticut. There, the Saybrook platform was adopted in 1708. Charles Hodge summarizes the content of the Saybrook platform this way: in giving, therefore, the exercise of discipline to the pastors and elders, and in making the determinations of councils definitive and binding on pain of non-communion, the Saybrook platform, unanimously approved by the assembly which prepared it in 1708, and adopted by the legislature as the discipline of the churches established by law, comes very little short of Presbyterianism. It's very evident, as this platform was a compromise between two parties, being less than the one and more than the other wished to see adopted, that one party must have been thoroughly Presbyterian. That they were, moreover, the stronger of the two is evident from the platform approaching so much nearer to their system than to that of the independents. The loss of the charter, then, and the response to that loss, in Connecticut at least, resulted in an even greater similarity between the Congregationalism of New England and modern Presbyterianism than I've indicated earlier. Furthermore, the date is crucial here. While there had been continual slow migration, both from New England and from Northern Ireland to the Middle Colonies throughout the second half of the 17th century, this migration from both sources increased early in the 18th century. Those Puritans who came to the Middle Colonies from southern New England in the early 18th century were particularly amenable to the Presbyterian mindset. And it was therefore most natural for them to join with the Scots-Irish, who were also arriving there in increased numbers. It's clear then that a variety of circumstances, all of them, under the sovereign control of God, a variety of circumstances contributed to make the middle colonies at the beginning of the 18th century particularly ripe for Presbyterian expansion. Wayland Dunaway, in the book I mentioned earlier, outlines the reasons for the massive migration of Scots-Irish Presbyterians to the middle colonies beginning early in the 18th century. As they came, they joined with New Englanders of similar persuasion to create a distinctly American Presbyterian church. Relations between these two groups in the New World may be seen to some degree in the origins of the very first presbytery. That presbytery was set up in 1706, largely as the result of the work of Francis McCamie, whom we've discussed earlier. Trinterud points out that the backgrounds of the seven ministers who joined McCamie in founding that first presbytery have been discussed at great length in the history of the church. And their background is most instructive as we try to understand what the American Presbyterian Church was going to become. Trinterud summarizes the credentials of these ministers of the first American Presbytery in this way. Francis McCamie, the first moderator of the Presbytery, was a Scots-Irishman with strong ties to both England and New England. Samuel Davis, the merchant pastor of Lewes, Delaware, probably came from Ireland. Three of the ministers in this newly formed presbytery were from New England. Jedediah Andrews, pastor of the church at Philadelphia, was a son of the New England Presbyterian and a graduate of Harvard College. John Wilson, pastor at Newcastle, was also from New England. Increase and Cotton Mather had been instrumental in sending him to Delaware, since many New Englanders were settling there on lands purchased by Connecticut. The third pastor from New England was Nathaniel Taylor of Patuxent, Maryland. George McNeish and John Hampton, whom the United Brethren had sent over to the colonies, were the other two charter members of the presbytery. McNeish was a Scot, and Hampton was Scots-Irish. The results of this particular mix of elements in the formation of the first presbytery, of this mix of the Scots-Irish and the New England elements, are noteworthy in two ways, according to Lefferts Letcher. Now I'm quoting Letcher. For one thing, the presbytery united in the persons of its seven ministers the two quite differing and often conflicting heritages of Puritan Presbyterianism and of Scotch and Scotch-Irish Presbyterianism, anticipating the pluralism, at times the polarity, that was to characterize American Presbyterianism. Second important feature of this first presbytery was that it was organized from the ground up and not from the top down, as was the Presbyterianism of Scotland, which had been adopted by Parliament and implemented by the General Assembly. In America, on the contrary, the higher judicatories were created by the lower, establishing the more democratic nature of American Presbyterianism and strengthening the concept that undelegated powers remain in the presbytery, not in the higher judicatories. This combination of ingredients continued to dominate the period of the transition of the Presbyterian Church from the Old World to the New. Going back now to Trinterud, who summarizes the development of the Synod in terms very similar to those that describe the formation of the first presbytery. This is Trinterud. By 1716, Presbyterian churches had so multiplied that a synod was formed to comprise four presbyteries: Philadelphia, Newcastle, Long Island, and Snow Hill, though the last named was never erected. 17 additional ministers had joined the church since its founding. 5 had come from New England, 3 from Wales, 6 from Scotland, 2 from Ireland, and 1 was of uncertain origin. He was probably a New Englander. Of the 8 Scots and Scots-Irish clergymen, 3 had been sent out by the Presbyterian ministers of London. The total number of ministers in active service was now 25, 8 Scotsmen, 7 Scots-Irishmen, 7 New Englanders, and 3 Welshmen. As one analyzes even more carefully the backgrounds of those individuals in early Presbyterianism who exercised the most influence on the development of the denomination, one is struck again with the degree to which New England Puritanism and Scots-Irish Presbyterianism predominated. Surely the two most famous names in early Presbyterianism were Dickinson and Tennant. Jonathan Dickinson was a graduate of Yale and was one of those Presbyterianized Congregationalists from Connecticut who consistently represented the New England perspective within Presbyterianism. William Tennant, the father of the Log College and the father of four famous sons, William Tennant had been educated at the University of Edinburgh and ordained by the General Synod of Ulster at Antrim in Northern Ireland. Together, Dickinson and Tennant provided the infant Presbyterian Church with the bulk of its theological leadership during the early days of its existence. Well, what did these two differing traditions bring to the new mix that was forming an American Presbyterian Church? Generally speaking, historians have argued that the Scots-Irish brought to the marriage a rigorous commitment to doctrinal orthodoxy. That is not to suggest, however, that New Englanders did not care about doctrinal orthodoxy. Their response to the doctrinal deviations of Roger Williams and Anne Hutchinson should leave no doubt that they were deeply concerned about major theological issues. However, the experience in Scotland and Ireland has led the Scots-Irish to be even more rigorously concerned about the degree to which doctrinal commitments must be precise and measured. Trent Arud describes the two major backgrounds of this perspective, that of the Scottish situation, going back indeed to the provisions of the Solemn League and Covenant and extending through the Marrow controversy, and that of the situation in Ulster, where the danger of Arianism had led to the development of rigorous subscriptionist standards. For their part, the New Englanders brought to the marriage a particularly strong emphasis upon experimental religion. Of course, the same disclaimer must be issued here as above. After all, it was the Tennant family with their Scots-Irish background. It was the Tennant family which led the Great Awakening in the Middle Colonies. Nevertheless, arising out of the narrative of grace criterion for church membership, the New Englanders tended to emphasize particularly strongly the degree to which a credible profession of personal faith in Jesus Christ was a vital ingredient in the qualification for church membership and for ordination to the ministry. At its best, any marriage builds upon the strengths of both partners, and this has to a large degree been true of American Presbyterians. Both a solid doctrinal foundation for piety and a warm, breathing orthodoxy describe what directed Presbyterianism in its transition from the old to the new world. The heritage of American Presbyterianism reminds one of two beautiful descriptions of the Christian life. William Ames begins his Marrow of Theology with these words: "Theology is the doctrine or teaching of living to God." Theology is the doctrine or teaching of living to God. Jonathan Edwards, who was probably America's greatest theologian, and who interestingly began his ministerial career as a Presbyterian pastor in New York, summarized his most important work, Treatise on Religious Affections, this way: "No light in the understanding is good, which does not produce holy affection in the heart." Ames' perspective, Edwards' perspective, these represent the best of American Presbyterianism as it arose out of the different strands which produced it. At the same time, divergent strands within a marriage may also produce tension, controversy. And this also happened in American Presbyterianism. It would not be too much to say, I believe, that the subscriptionist controversy, which resulted in the adopting Act of 1729, arose at least partially out of the clash of New England and Scots-Irish perspectives. Furthermore, the more divisive controversy that developed during the Great Awakening and resulted in the first split in the Presbyterian Church might be said to have its roots in the divergent backgrounds of members of the church. While it certainly is oversimplistic to try to identify either side in either controversy with one particular group, nevertheless, because the New Englanders placed greater priority on the experience of individual conversion, and because the Scots-Irish placed greater priority on doctrinal orthodoxy, the marriage of the two was almost certain to produce some friction. That friction reappears frequently in the history of the Presbyterian Church throughout the middle part of the 18th century and right down to the end of the 20th century. I have two final and quick points to be made with regard to the heritage of American Presbyterianism. First, most of what I've said has been focused upon the degree to which New England Puritanism must legitimately be said to have been Presbyterian, at least in thrust. The reason I spent so much time on this is that frequently in Presbyterian circles, the Puritan component of our heritage is neglected or relegated to secondary status. As a matter of fact, the New England Puritans were, as I've sought to demonstrate, in most ways Presbyterian in their ecclesiology as well as in their theology. Furthermore, their contribution to Reformed theology in America and to the Presbyterian tradition is supremely important. In addition to all the points made above, it should be noted that the first president of the College of New Jersey, which was, by the way, the Presbyterian's first college in the New World, first president of the College of New Jersey was a New Englander, Jonathan Dickinson. Furthermore, there's abundant evidence to suggest that if the Lord had spared Jonathan Edwards, who served less than 3 months as president of the college before dying of smallpox in 1758, the history of Christianity and the history of the Presbyterian Church in the United States would have been very different. Under the extended leadership of John Witherspoon, Scottish common sense philosophy, rather than the affectionate piety of Edwards, came to dominate the nation's and the church's religious life. Therefore, my point is that understanding New England Puritanism, particularly as it reached its zenith in Edwards, might very well be a most profitable exercise for 20th century Presbyterians who would reclaim the best of their heritage. Nevertheless, New England Puritanism without the extraordinarily valuable Scots-Irish contribution would not be American Presbyterianism. Confessionalism with piety, light in the understanding which produces holy affection in the heart. It's this combination that produced American Presbyterianism, and it is this combination that we would do well to reclaim today. Finally, what about the corporate sense that was so vital to the Presbyterianized Congregationalism of New England? Have we adequately taken account of what this concept can and should mean for us as Christians, as Presbyterians in the 20th century? Modern Presbyterians affirm this notion in ecclesiastical matters, but tend, possibly without adequate reflection, to ignore its possible implication in civil affairs. Does the political unit of which we are a part have any corporate identity and responsibility before God? Or have we so thoroughly severed church from state that we no longer even ask questions about the holiness of the state of which we're a part? A denomination as a whole can be more or less faithful to the Word of God. When it is more faithful, it stands in a line of blessing, and when it is less faithful, it stands in a line of judgment. Can the same be said in any way of political units? The New England Puritans and their Presbyterian brothers in Scotland in the mid-17th century thought it could. But the loss of the New England Charter in 1684, the emigration of Scots and Scots-Irish Presbyterians to a pluralistic environment in the middle colonies led to a dramatic modification of this answer to the question. Most historians concede that such modification arose out of historical circumstance, but few have adequately addressed the question of whether that modification was biblical. The question remains for us today. Is it possible that at least on this issue, the Puritans of early New England were more consistent Presbyterians than we are today.